Hello, everyone. Welcome to Laser Focus, the deep dive pop culture podcast from Nerdist. My name's Kyle Anderson. Thank you for joining me. This week, I'm talking to, listen, we all work for a place called Nerdist. We're all nerds about various hither and thither things. I'm here today talking to somebody who is the biggest nerd I know about one particular thing. He is a single issue voter when it comes to nerd properties. That's not true. He likes other stuff too, but he is, you will know his work, if not his name or face, although you probably know his name and face. He is the head of post-production and also the, I guess, lead editor on most of the video content here on the channel, as well as an enormous fan of the series, books, movies, etc. Dune. Please welcome to the show, Matt Caron. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Kyle. How you doing?
You're welcome.
Right out of the bat. Right out of the bat.
You had to do it. Yeah, so I do want to, before we get too far into this, because we're going to talk about, you know, Dune as a fandom and everything like that as the movie is about to come out, we do want to just tell you right up front that Nerdist is owned by, Nerdist is a subsidiary of Legendary Digital Networks, which itself is a branch of Legendary Entertainment. Legendary Pictures makes the Dune movies, as well as the Godzilla movies and other stuff. So, just up front, this is not a shill for our parent company, but it is funny to know that like all of our offices are in the building where they make Dune, and your personal office is just floor to ceiling Dune stuff. And so it's important to point out that, and you're quick to say this, it's not just me filling in the blanks for people, that you were a fan way before they made the movies.
I'm pretty sure I was a fan of Dune before Legendary even existed. So
it's very possible.
I think, yeah, because what, Legendary started in like 2005 or 2004 or something like that.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, I read the books before that.
Yeah. But I do want to say, like, you know, we'll get into your history and stuff like that. But like, what is it like, somebody who is a lifelong fan of this, of these books and this world, to be like, well, now there's this huge giant movie that is like Oscar nominated and winning, won a bunch of Oscars. Like, is that gratifying, or are you like, you guys don't appreciate?
Oh yeah, I mean, no. I mean, no. Middle school me, the middle school part of my brain that still exists, has been freaking out the last few years. You know, it's one of those things where it's like, finally, everything I love is in the main lexicon and people know what I'm talking about finally, and maybe they still don't. But yeah, no, I mean, it's one of those things where you obviously, you know, it's not fun to gatekeep or do anything nasty. It's more of just like, oh, sick. Everyone's now in the Dune party, and it's a good time.
Yeah, that's the way I feel. I mean, like, it's still not quite in the same vein, but like, because I'm late to the party on this, like, admittedly, but like when I first started getting into Doctor Who in 2009, it was very much like, oh, this is something that in North America is still pretty niche. And, you know, and then just a year or two after that, you'd see like billboards for it in Los Angeles, because like it became like this big push, you know, from BBC America. So it's like, it was like, amazing to be like, oh my God, this thing I like that no one I know had ever seen or like heard of, maybe not heard of, but is now like huge. Yeah. It's in the zeitgeist and stuff. And
it's wild when you see like interest in something that you identify with so much that you're just like, wait, this is so wild that I thought this little thing that was secret to me is now suddenly shared out there with everyone else. And yeah, I don't know, it just makes it more inclusive and really exciting to be able to talk about it. And
I mean it's like, and these are like, these movies have like A-list people in them and A-list directors, and like this is like,
yeah, it's kind of
like, as mainstream as this property has ever been.
I mean, it's the celebrity aspect alone, it was just such a huge push to like get people excited about it, because it's just like, yeah, how do you sell the main premise of Dune to, you know, kids in high school today, or, you know, people with like that want to go see movies. So of course you got to get like the hot young actors in there and just like all these big names. It's kind of like, what was it, like you know, when Superman came out or like any of these big IP back in the day, like the key was just like cast a bunch of like really big name actors and that will like get everybody in there. You know, you're just trying to hit all the demographics because Dune by itself doesn't really hit all of the main demographics.
Yeah. Well, we've seen like, you know, people are really trying to do these big, you know, space opera is, you know, like world building type stuff. And it's like, even with like very established people in it, it doesn't always guarantee because people I don't know what this is. I'm not going to go see it. And it's, I mean, it's like
so many classic science fiction films that, you know, you and I can just rattle off now. You know, a lot of them were bombs when they aired originally in the theater. You know, it's only with time that they became cult classics and then, you know, kind of recoup their costs. But yeah, no, I'm really excited that just everything Dune now is just firing on all cylinders and just hot out the gate. It's pretty rad.
So how did you discover the books and, you know, what made you latch onto them the way that you have?
My favorite thing about the book itself was that I don't know how a copy of it got into my house when I was a kid. So, because my dad, he's the one who introduced me to like things like the Narnia Chronicles and Lord of the Rings, but he had never read Dune. And my mom isn't really a science fiction reader. So like, I remember asking my parents, like, where did this book come from? None of us knew. So I don't know if I grabbed it at like a garage sale or like some family friends lent it to us or something. So it was just always this thing on my bookshelf that was very intimidating to read. But I think it was like a mixture of that showed up right around probably when the Sci-Fi Channel miniseries was coming around, because that was a big thing for them. That advertised for months. And that was such an investment in a production at the time. I mean, parts of the production value don't hold up now. But I think, you know, I would have been like 10 or 11 when that series came out. And that was like the perfect time for me to latch onto something. I was always fascinated with like science fiction and aliens. So you would get like fun little book fair books that were like, here's an encyclopedia about aliens. And then you read a little section about giant sandworms on this planet of Arrakis. And so that always like piqued my interest. So trying to get all of that together right around like 10 or 11 years old. And then trying to read the book, not succeeding, only getting a few pages in before it kind of was too thick or too dense to read. And but no, I just kept trying and it just fascinated me because the opening chapter is all about this young kid who wakes up and there's this witch in his house that's coming to test him. And he lives in a castle. And it's kind of weird when you pick it up thinking this is science fiction. Why does it sound like it's medieval? So yeah, it just always captured me from the start and always fascinated me until like, you know, a couple years of trying to get through the dense part at the beginning. I finally got through it and it was awesome.
What was it about it that finally clicked with you?
I think when I read it all the way through the first time, I must have been like, you know, 11 or 12, maybe 13 or something. And that's like the perfect age for, you know, a young kid to identify with Paul and think like, yeah, he's the hero. He's awesome. He wins. And then, you know, just some loose spoilers here for everybody. If you haven't read the book, I mean, you find out he's not really the good guy. It's not the white savior story. But, you know, you read it a few years later when you're a little older. And then things start kind of clicking. You're like, wait a minute, he wins. But okay, not everything is right. You know, there's some weird manipulative things going on. Not everybody is pure black and white, good and evil. You know, everybody's a bit in the gray. And so, yeah, it was just kind of fascinating I think that was the first time, you know, reading a book where you're like, okay, not everybody is just a good guy. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just your standard fairy tale. And then, yeah, on top of that, just a mix of other things in the book. You know, I was raised, you know, I was raised Christian. So I go to church every Sunday, and I don't think I had ever come across a book that had utilized so many themes from Islam or exposed me to much culture like that. And I'm kind of hard strapped to think of another science fiction classic that kind of uses religion in the way that it did. So I always found that fascinating, just something that kind of broke me out of my normal sphere of things I did come in contact with where I grew up.
I mean, there was so much stigma on that kind of science fiction and high fantasy as well for such a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it really, I mean, Tolkien was like the most approachable for a lot of young people.
Oh, yeah.
But even
like when we were all younger, it's like, you know, I was a big Lord of the Rings nerd. Like,
yeah,
that and Dune are like my two big like lore kind of deep dives. And I was the Lord of the Rings nerd. Like, I had someone rip my book in half because I was reading it all the time. And they're like, this stuff is so nerdy. And then I was like, yeah. So it was just like, that's the kind of stuff that I was fascinated with. Just having very dense, well thought out histories and mythologies. That's another variable as to why I latched onto Dune as much as I did.
Well, nowadays lore is so like integral to the way that a lot of people enjoy science fiction and fantasies. Like, what are these worlds? And like, they want, you know, how many lore deep dives can you find on the internet?
Yeah.
How many have we written? You know what I mean? Like,
oh, yeah. I mean, like, and Dune has a lot of fun stuff where you can go real surface level with it. And then you can go like really in the weeds. Like the fact that Frank Herbert essentially wrote like, what is the stock exchange value of spice? And there's a whole like system of checks and balances within their government. And you're just like, why would you need to know that? But certain things from that are important when you get near the end of the book. So it's just fascinating to me that you could get that much into detail when just making something up.
So what year did the first book come out?
First book came out in 1965, but it was originally released in serialized format in Analog Magazine starting in December, I think, 1963. It was just released in different segments. There's some like cool art that came along with it that, you know, is pretty old and rare to find. Frank Herbert published it as a novel in 1965. Yeah, I mean, you want me to go into the whole history of like how he kind of came up with all of that? Or,
sure.
Because it's like, it was fascinating because Frank Herbert, he was a writer, but mostly his, you know, his paycheck was coming from just being a newspaper reporter. And the story goes that he was doing research on a beach preservation project up in Oregon. To prevent the erosion of sand dunes. And so, you know, he just was at this beach and he was thinking about, you know, how humans try to shape our environment and long-term goals that you need to implement to really have an impact on preserving certain parts of the environment, and just seeing how you can't just ignore all aspects of the ecology of a system. You have to, you can't just like go dump sand on a beach to say, here, I preserved the dunes. It's like, no, you have to plant certain grasses and be aware of certain wind patterns and water patterns and erosion, all working together to, you know, create this lasting impact that you would need on the environment. And so then he was thinking about, okay, long-term goals. What if ecology could be used as a religion? You know, how would that be wielded in a way to inspire masses of people to all contribute towards this end goal? And then, you know, from that, mixed with the political environment at the time, you know, using charismatic leaders and religious leaders as ways to lead masses of people on a path into the future, that all kind of like melded together. He had had a few previous writings that kind of explored some of his themes and ideas of secret societies and psychology and using psychology as a religion and myth and manipulating people into doing things. But Dune really becomes the book where like all of his previous writing kind of congeals into this perfect amalgam that just works really well as a story. I mean, he figured out, okay, all of this stuff needs to happen to someone. So then he writes a story about Paul Atreides, and then it turns into a commentary on the, you know, Hero of a Thousand Faces, the mm-hmm. white savior story, and kind of subverts a lot of that stuff.
And what's really interesting about the book too, the first book, because I haven't read the other ones, but that you know, throughout the book that there's stuff behind the scenes, like, like puppeting him essentially to get to the point where he can be the hero or whatever. Like, you know, from early on that the Bene Gesserit did not actually want Lady Jessica to have a boy. And but then it's like, well, now he's here. So now what can we do? How can we use this to our advantage and everything? And that, you know, if you're just watching just Paul's story without any of the other stuff, you might go, okay, he's the hero by the end. But because of all that other stuff, which is the way, you know, humanity works, it's all very political, just across the board. You can't live without politics, essentially, whether no matter how hard you try.
I've read that first book so many times, and every time I still catch something that's just like, oh my God, what is this tiny little detail that Frank Herbert just like buried in a sentence and then just keeps going. And if you miss it, you know, you're just like, oh, there's some grander implications just on this like single sentence. And yeah, it's just really fascinating that every time you realize, like, you know, Paul is kind of a victim of circumstance, and not kind of, he is. But just, yeah, where was I going with this? I mean, it's fascinating just seeing how all these parts click together, and how, you know, Paul isn't really the only only protagonist of his story. Everybody has motivations and really well thought out backgrounds. Yeah, it's just amazing how rich it all is, and how that all works together. Because no, it's like, again, it's the classic thing: the best villains are ones who think that they're the heroes of their own story. So,
right,
you know, everybody has their own reasons for doing stuff, and it's just beautiful how it all clashes together.
Do you think? I mean, because obviously we don't want to spoil it for people who haven't read all the books, or, you know, even know what's going to happen in this second movie or anything like that. But like, do you think there is ultimately an actual capital H hero? You know what I mean? Like, who is the actual good guy, good person?
Yeah.
If it's not Paul,
it's so hard to tell. I mean, cause it's just like, yeah, as the books go on, you get, you know, other characters, you get descendants, you get characters coming back, you know, all with their own missions and goals. It's so hard to tell, like, you know, even when you have heroes like Duncan Idaho, who, again, cool name for how goofy it sounds. You know, he is supposed to be the ideal, like, he's like the Lancelot of the Arthurian legend. You know, he's the gifted swordsman. He's the one that has true allegiance to his Duke Leto and then to Paul. But, you know, even as the books go on, you know, it's meant to point out the flaws in, you know, if you are someone with undying loyalty to someone, you know, why, you know, and even he has a lot of faults where he has to grow over time, to really analyze, like, you know, why am I doing what I'm doing? Like, should I be my own person, or, you know, what faults are within me that I can analyze and improve on? So, yeah, I mean, that's just what's so beautiful about it, is that Frank writes in a way that Frank Herbert writes in a way that makes you have to question. You can't just have a clear answer about any of these characters or any of these events, because everything has its own perspective. And you know, I think a good example is the Fremen, right? The Fremen are the indigenous people of Arrakis, and suddenly this outsider comes in and claims, like, hey, I can help lead you to your prophesized paradise. Like, I wanna help make Arrakis into a beautiful homeworld where you're not overruled by some outside family, or, you know, the Imperium. But then you see how, you know, the Fremen have a lot of altruistic tendencies, but then, you know, they're just as much victims of outside manipulation. You see that, you know, as the book ends, and there's, you know, all of this stuff that Paul sees of a holy war spreading throughout the universe. It's like, okay, yeah, I mean, the Fremen just aren't necessarily all good guys. Like, in the second book and the third book, you have a lot of conspiracies and civil war among the Fremen, all through, you know, religious reasons, through political reasons. So yeah, it's like every time you think, like, oh, cool, they're with the good guys now, no, it's everybody's on a spectrum with that stuff. It's great.
Yeah. And it makes it so much that, like, you know, because Paul has a very, like, specific reason to be doing what he's doing, which effectively is revenge. Like, mm-hmm. he wants to take down the Harkonnens because of what they did to his family and his father specifically. And so, and he also has all these, you know, these gifts that can help these people. And so he might be like, I'm going to help these people. And they, being that they had, you know, been under the thumb of the Imperium and the Harkonnen specifically for such a long time, they go, yeah, I'll follow this guy, sure. And it's like, you just see how easy it is for people to be manipulated when they're just looking for help. Yeah. You know, yeah. They're looking, I don't want to keep saying, you know, I don't want to say Messiah or Savior, but that's legitimately what,
well, I mean,
Paul
it's
to them in a way.
In some of, like, the background and lore of, like, of Dune itself, it explains how, like, there's a spirit called the Great Mother, where people kind of create this goddess mythology as humanity spread throughout the universe. And so, you know, Frank Herbert kind of was thinking in terms of, okay, the further out we explore into the cosmos and the more unknowns we have, you know, religion tries to fill a lot of that unknown, that void. And so we revert back to a lot of these Jungian archetypes that Frank Herbert was a big fan of, you know, like the mother, the father, all of these types of things, that people latch onto leaders because we believe that a Superman, a Messiah, can solve all the answers. And in an instance with Paul and his prescience, you know, how many times do you or anybody think about, like, oh man, I wish I could tell the future. I wish I could see what's coming up in my future. You know, people follow Paul because they think he delivers that promise. But then Paul eventually kind of discovers, it's like, okay, if I can actually see my future, you know, how self-fulfilling of this prophecy is it? Am I the one falling into this predetermined path, this trap of seeing the future, or how malleable is the future? So you get, yeah, I mean, the main thing that, like, you get in the later books is you see that people fall in line to try and get answers and control the unpredictable side of the future, but really you can't. And that's the problem. That's the conflict there for a lot of the religious side of Dune.
I think about this a lot. I mean, because you and I talked, I think, last week at some point about how that idea of, like, you can see the path forward and you know what you're going to do is very similar to Dr. Manhattan and Watchmen, where, like, you mm-hmm. he knows what's about to happen. And he doesn't do anything. He just goes, well, this is what I have to do at this point, yeah. because this is what
could,
I do.
If you could tell exactly what your future is going to be, then, you know, your life becomes static. All of your time, you know, your four dimensional journey through time would just all collapse to a single point. You would be stuck in stasis. And so, you know, that's something that Frank Herbert tries to analyze, especially with some later characters that have, like, perfect prescience. Mm. You know, going back to who is a hero and who isn't, you know, Paul has to, you know, guide humanity into a future that he alone can see a path to salvation or survival for all of humanity. But in order to do that, he has to go along a darker path, kind of like, you know, a good analogy from today would be, like, you know, Doctor Strange in Infinity War and Endgame. He's like, all right, there's only one way we're going to win. I can't tell you exactly how we're going to do it, but, you know, for that successful plan, there has to be some sacrifices made along the way. Or there's a Rick and Morty episode, right, where Morty gets death crystals and he sees this far future of, like, oh, he's going to die with Jessica by his side, right? But what does he have to do along the way to ensure this very clear, straightforward path? You know, it's exactly like that. Like, what would happen along that, and what sacrifices would you have to make to ensure the best future that no one else would be able to understand or comprehend what you can see?
And it just, I mean, and it kind of plays with the morality of it as well, because, like, mm-hmm. you, if you know that path and it's a dark path and people are going to be sacrificed, but you go, well, I have to, because that's the path. You know,
I mean,
what I mean?
It's all Machiavellian kind of stuff. Yeah. It's like, I mean, I'll spoil a little bit of one of the later books, but just the overall plot is of God Emperor of Dune is you have a character that lives for thousands of years, who intentionally is a tyrannical dictator that rules the empire, and he oppresses everybody. He limits space travel. He hoards all of the spice and just dishes it out in very small quantities. So he has ultimate control over the entire Imperium. But the idea is, you know, only he is aware of, he's like, look, I have to be such a jerk that when I'm gone, humankind will remember from this point on to never put all of their faith into a single leader like myself. And so, you know, he knows that when he's gone, then humanity will scatter and diversify across the universe, but only through teaching them how bad it could possibly be is what he believes is the best way to teach that lesson. So it's you know, in the book, outsiders view him as like, yeah, he's a villain. They refer to him as the tyrant. But in his mind, it's like you come to understand. It's like, okay, he is making this personal sacrifice of turning himself into a sandworm. Yeah, it gets weird. Turning himself into a sandworm so he can live for thousands of years and isolating himself. Like, he's the only one that can understand the world he does. And it's very isolating. It's weird, but it makes sense. It makes sense when you read it.
Cause it gets really like, it's very like tactile and like relatable in a lot of ways, but it also is this wild metaphysical kind of treatise on, on just a lot of, you know, human evolution. I mean, cause this is supposed to be, you know, hundreds of thousands of years or whatever in the future. Yeah. But we're still people, you know.
I mean, what's great is you have characters that, you know, you have the Bene Gesserit, that there are a society of women that can, I mean, everyone in this future is all like superpowered, essentially. Like, you have the society of women that they can control every molecular process in their bodies. You know, they're fully attuned with their minds and can read other people almost as if they're psychic. You have Mentats, which are human computers that they can basically just like process vast amounts of knowledge and numbers. You know, because this is a world without computers, without advanced machinery, humankind has had to evolve itself, but it depends all on spice, pretty much. But then as the books continue, you do get characters that remember. They're like, oh, I'm human. I need to engage with my emotional side. Like, you know, here in my office, I have a painting of Van Gogh's Thatched Cottages at Courtauld. And there's a character that kind of has a dissociative side of her personality that is the part that retains her human emotions, rather than her just, you know, very black and white, very stoic side that is outward facing. But like, her human side latches onto memories of this painting. And through that, you know, a tear might come to her eye, or she understands what love is. She reconnects with human emotion and artistic endeavors. So it's stuff like that is peppered throughout. And it's fascinating to try and see like the conflict within these characters of like, oh yeah, I have to remember like ancient humans relied on love. Whereas now, like, you know, Bene Gesserit are trained to only use love as a manipulative tool.
I want to bring up some fun parallels between Doctor Who and Dune.
Yeah.
Which, in the 1970s, there was a story called The Pirate Planet, which was written by Douglas Adams. Mm-hmm. Yes, the Hitchhiker's Guide guy. He was the lead writer for a while, for not that long, actually. But in that story, there's a group of characters called the Mentiads, who are a psychic gestalt mind group who are essentially like, they don't see evil in people. They don't understand that this pirate captain who is piloting this planet that is essentially like strip mining other planets. He's using their kind of, you know, psychic powers for his own machinations. And they just kind of go, well, I guess this is what's supposed to happen, you know? And obviously the words are pretty similar and like the design is slightly different, but they are kind of like, a mixture of several like Dune things. And I have to believe, because this was in like the late 70s, that Douglas Adams read Dune when it came out and was just like, this is great. I'm going to use
this.
Because he did that. He's, you know, they do that a bunch in Doctor Who. Yeah. There's just,
I mean,
like
even Frank Herbert himself, like I found recently, there was some other little sci-fi short story from another science fiction magazine that is, you know, the body shields in Dune of the slow blade penetrates the shield. You know, any fast kinetic object that's coming in contact or impacting the shield doesn't break through. And there was some other short story that I'm slipping my name now, but you just see how it's like, oh, here's your body shield. And anything that hits it with, you know, strong enough force, it's instantly annihilated and sent into hyperspace. But if you go slowly, then you can kill the person within. And it came out like a few years before Dune. And so, yeah, it's always interesting to kind of trace these little like plagiarizing moments or little snippets that other science fiction writers steal from the other. Or just, you know, like I'm working on something right now that's comparing Dune and Foundation. And you see how Frank Herbert was really inspired by a lot of stuff in Foundation, but wrote Dune as more of an antithetical approach to it. So, you know, it's fascinating seeing how science fiction evolves and all of the different waves and periods of it.
Yeah, it's, and also just like, I mean, you put out a video, was that a couple of years ago now, of just all of the, that you could find at the time.
Yeah.
Dune references in other stuff, be it science fiction or not.
Yeah.
And it's truly amazing how many things there are that, like, I mean, some of them are very obvious, like The Simpsons has a bunch of very obvious references and things like that.
But no, I was not expecting to uncover like an episode of Punky Brewster or The Facts of Life. And, you know, a lot of those things were just, you know, properties around the time of the 1984 movie that would probably just be referencing Dune for, or, you know, David Lynch's Dune for, I don't know, being a meme at the time of being a box office bomb or a silly, goofy science fiction movie. But yeah, it really is fascinating seeing how much Dune has inspired like a lot of writers for television shows and movies. And they just drop those little nuggets in there.
I do want to talk about the David Lynch movie because, so the first time I watched it was several years back and I was like, what the hell is this? Like,
yeah,
you know, I was like, I knew it was kind of like a movie that was imperfect, let's say.
Yeah.
But I didn't know the story at all. I was going in completely, you know, devoid of any preconceived notions. And it's really hard to follow if you don't know what's going on.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's got a very slow start. You know, you have all those inner monologue bits with the voiceover, and even those don't make things very clear. I mean, I love how bonkers it is. I mean, it's just like, I think the first time I finally watched, I mean, I would catch it on TV or I don't know, I would catch it every now and then, but had never watched it in its completeness until like, I think late into high school or early college or something like that. Knowing full well, it's like, okay, this is a product of the 80s and it doesn't have state-of-the-art effects. But being able to follow along with it, even I was just like, okay, that's an interesting choice. That's okay. They're glazing over a lot of stuff. Because yeah, it's like, unfortunately that movie just had to have so much cut out of it that it just really falls into a bit of a generic, you know, white savior story. And, you know, just Paul is the hero at the end and that's it. Like he's a good guy. But you know, that was also just studio interference and trying to make the next Star Wars. It's a neat little relic of its time.
Yeah.
But, I don't know. It's pretty bonkers.
I have a straight up love of those post Star Wars, like ripoff movies.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
I love them so much because some of them are very like slapdash and crappy, but they're, and some of them, I mean, money was spent on Dune. Like it's not like they phoned it in.
No.
And even like, you know, Roger Corman put money into Battle Beyond the Stars, which I adore, but it's like a very imperfect movie. And that's another one that got like, the effects are by James Cameron. The music is by a young James Horner. The script was by John Sayles. Like, there were some people putting, you know, good work into it. And because it was so expensive, you know, Corman's whole thing was like, you spend a little bit amount of money, you make just, you know, you make more than you spent, and that's a win. But like, as we know from today, the more you spend, the more you have to make, and then the more likely it is to lose money. And so at a certain point, they were, you know, running out of budget and time. And, you know, as the story goes, like, Corman walked, and it was, Sayles wrote Seven Samurai in space. Like, that's what he wrote. Like, specifically, it's that same story, but in space. And he, Corman went to the, you know, the soundstage, and was informed that they were behind and out of, you know, running out of money. And he just, like, thumbed through the script of what was left to shoot, tore out seven pages, fired two people, and left.
Jeez.
So, like, there's huge chunks of the end of that movie too, same as Dune.
I mean, where Dune, like, Dune's so funny, where De Laurentiis was just like, get it under 2 hours. It's 2 hours and I think 17 minutes or 11 or 17 minutes, something around there. But yeah, you can see how the final half hour of the movie is just like them being like,
so fast.
We still have like half of the book to get through.
Yeah. And all the stuff that, I mean, because I've come around to the David Lynch movie. First of all, I like David Lynch now, like in a way that I didn't. That took me a while to get on his wavelength.
Yeah.
And then
Dune,
also
Dune is like his Alien 3 for David Fincher.
100%.
His first major big commercial blockbuster, and just a lot of studio interference and a lot of bad circumstances just made for a very unhappy experience for him. And just, you know, a shadow of a movie that could have been.
And you can tell the stuff that he actually enjoyed, which is all the Harkonnen stuff.
Oh, yeah. Like, I mean, like, all the weird stuff is awesome. I love all the weird stuff. It's just a shame that, like, you could just feel it's like, oh, crap, we got to get to the end right now. And it's just like,
yeah,
cross dissolve of war montage. And it's just like, and then Paul and Johnny fell in love. And boom,
yeah. Like, and you're like, who is this character even? Yeah. Like, she's barely in it. It's funny because the first Denis Villeneuve movie, I'm like, well, this is all the stuff I've seen, because this is the part that, like, they actually spent the time on in the David Lynch movie.
But they could actually have time to even, like, you know, add flourishes to that and add importance and weight to it. Because, I mean, that, you know, another screen adaptation is the Sci-Fi Channel series. And I don't remember there is a director's cut of that as well. I don't remember the exact differences. But, you know, for turning the first book into three, like, hour and a half episodes each, it's awesome to get to see a bunch of stuff portrayed on screen, but at the same time, it also follows the book sometimes a little too much by default. Like, it just kind of bogs the whole thing down. You know, each episode has a good break point, an act structure, but you're just like, yeah, you know what? I don't need this part contributing to, like, the main part of the story. Even though for a lot of us Dune fans, it is really great to see the famous banquet scene, which is a great scene in the book. But, you know, putting that on screen, it's just people sitting around a table, one-upping each other in arguments. And so it doesn't really translate to exciting cinema.
Yeah, it looks like the director's cut has 30 extra minutes from the television cut. And it's 295, the director's cut, 295 minutes, which is substantial.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great miniseries to watch. I mean, just going in with the understanding of they were dealing with a TV budget and 2000 era computer graphics. Mm-hmm. So, like, the ships look kind of like PS2 graphic, or not even PS2, like just PlayStation 1 graphics levels. There's a lot of stuff that they shot on a sound stage where you can just see where the floor ends. And then the wall with the rear projection, it's not even green screen, it's all rear projection, where that starts. And it's also exposed brighter than the people on the set. So none of it's really matching. The colors are all off, but I still love it. It's great to get to at least see a lot of stuff finally adapted to the screen.
Yeah. And, like, you know, you were showing me some of that stuff, and it's very obvious that it's like soundstagey, but it's like, now we live in a world where, you know, the volume gets used all the time and you can tell when it's the volume. So it's like, how is that much different other than just like, now we have HD TVs and we can see it a little easier.
Oh yeah. Yeah. The Sci-Fi Channel miniseries was meant to be watched on a cathode ray TV in 4:3 in standard definition. You were not supposed to watch that in high definition.
That era of the Sci-Fi Channel, back before it was SIFI, when it was just the Sci-Fi Channel, was so fascinating because they, you know, they brought Mystery Science Theater over, but then wanted to have an overarching, like serialized narrative to the wraparound segments, which is silly because it's, they showed them out of order anyway. Yeah, so it's ridiculous. But then also, you know, they would show a bunch of old sci-fi stuff, but then they would make these new things and like,
Lived for the monthly Sci-Fi Channel original movie. Like, I loved those things. They were terrible, but I loved them. I would just always like mark out my Friday night for like first Friday of the month was always like the Sci-Fi Channel original movie.
And they would show previews for it every commercial break for a month.
It was a big deal. It was so rad. I miss that era of Sci-Fi Channel because it was just like cool. Like, and plus they would always just be playing like Star Trek TOS on repeat. Yeah. So
and then they would eventually get these like, you know, still, you know, I guess cult classic, but like big movies. Like I remember when they showed the David Lynch Dune on the Sci-Fi Channel, or when they got Blade Runner, the final cut to come to the Sci-Fi Channel.
Well, and I always like, tell you, I always tell the funny story of how when they got Battlefield Earth to air on the Sci-Fi Channel, and as a kid, I thought, whoa, this is great for a Sci-Fi Channel original movie, having no idea that it was a theatrically released movie. So I'm sitting there thinking like, yeah, it's not great, but it's awesome for a TV movie. And then years later, I finally found out. I was like, oh no, that was a theatrically released box office bomb.
This is neither here nor there, but do you remember the Lost in Space movie that they made in the late 90s?
Oh, okay. Not the Will Ferrell. I thought you were about to bring up the Will Ferrell one. No, but it was still Marty and Croft, right?
Who was the TV show? The TV show was from the 60s. And it was very, you know, kind of a hokey, like, whatever. Family Law. I mean, it's literally Swiss Family Robinson, but in space. Their name is Robinson and everything. But they tried to make it like a cool action, like sci-fi movie. Oh, and no, Gary Oldman is in it, and William Hurt. And the big one was Matt LeBlanc as like the cool action hero pilot guy.
Oh wait, no, sorry. I thought you said Land of the Lost.
No,
Lost in Space. Yes, I loved that movie.
Yes, I saw that. Very flawed movie. I remember going to see that. I had the soundtrack, I had the action figures, like basically anything at that time. If I liked it, I would get all the stuff for it. And
I worked at a post-production company years ago. And one of our editors, or there was some shoot that we needed to film where, we needed someone from SAG on set, like an actual SAG member. And we were like, oh crap. Who does anyone here have SAG-AFTRA membership? And the editor goes, oh, I do. And we're like, what were you in? He goes, oh, I was Will Robinson in Lost in Space.
No, really?
And we're like, what? And then you look at his face and you're like, oh my God, yes, you're the kid grown up. And like, he had a little action figure of himself. So yeah, Jack is a great guy.
That's so funny.
It was just like, he's like, yeah, I didn't really do much after that, but it was fun. So yeah, I remember that movie, seeing that. I saw that at a drive-in, and that was a trip.
Danger, Will Robinson. Danger. Again, Lost in Space, something else that they have since remade.
Sorry, I was, you were describing it, and I was like, I think he's describing the people that starred in Lost in Space, not Land of the Lost.
I don't know if I said Land of the Lost, but if I did, I apologize.
No, I don't know why I was thinking that though. But anyways.
Science fiction of that era is what got me on that kick. But so, once the sci-fi miniseries, the two of them, came out, that was the early 2000s. what was the Dune fandom, if you will, like between then and when the Villeneuve movies got announced?
Well, I mean, honestly, Dune fandom would have been, you know, just your odd forums here and there. I think Byron Merritt is this guy. He is Frank Herbert's grandson. He was really like a big moderator on a lot of online forums, you know, in just those early internet days. You know, I this is all me kind of discovering stuff way after the fact, because, you know, growing up in Virginia, no one knew what Dune was.
Like, of course,
no one. I would be the kid at school and everyone would be talking about the Star Wars prequels that had just come out. And I go, oh, this is like that movie Dune. And people are like, what are you talking about? And so, yeah, I kind of had to bottle it up a little bit as a kid because no one would understand what I would be talking about. But yeah, it wasn't until, like, you know, I went to film school and finally, like, got more exposure to more David Lynch stuff, and everyone was like, oh, you know what Dune is, and, you know, finding friends that also like schlocky sci-fi movies and everything. So that was always fun, like slowly learning. I was like, oh, okay, I'm not alone in all of this. Like, there's other people that love silly sci-fi movies. Yeah, the Dune in the 90s is a weird kind of historical trip, because you had a lot of the early computer games in the early 90s that without those, you wouldn't have things like StarCraft or Warcraft or, you know, World of Warcraft or any of these RTS games that were all built on the framework of the early Dune computer games. You know, the point and clicks, like go harvest spice and then build up your resources and stave off attacks from the enemies and everything. You know, that was what Command and Conquer was built off of. So you had all of the early computer games. I am a big collector of the Dune CCG, the collectible card game that came out in the late 90s that was trying to get some success, you know, after the popularity of Magic in the mid 90s. Every big IP at the time was like, oh, we need a collectible card game. So I have a bunch of cards from the Dune game. Trying to think. Oh, I mean, even before that, in the late 70s, there was the Dune board game that was released, but then ran out of print pretty early on. So there was a good, like, underground collective of people playing this intense strategy war game. I think in the early 2000s, well, what, in 2000, there was an RPG that was released, but Wizards of the Coast bought up the publishing company at the time and only released 3,000 limited edition copies of this RPG that was built. So, you know, it's like all these tiny little things that never really flourished or developed past their first iterations. That's kind of what peppered Dune subculture all through the 90s and early 2000s. And then I think mid 2000s, they had started spinning the wheels on, like, you know, developing Dune movies, because, like, there was going to be like a Peter Berg Dune movie and a few other directors were lined up. But they all just kind of started and fizzled out.
I wish I knew what the actual beginning of these were, but, like, all of these, and maybe it was Game of Thrones, maybe it was Lord of the Rings, like all these things where it's like, let's look for properties that have big, long, you know, either book series or, you know, manga, in the case of, like, they've been trying to make an Akira movie for a million years, a movie series, because there's so many volumes of the manga and everything. And how many times, like, it's honestly, I won't say a miracle, because obviously a lot of people worked really hard on it, but that Dune itself, I think it took the passion of all the people who made it in order to get it to the screen, because so many of these other titles just never found anything.
I mean,
it's a hard sell. I have to say,
Dune is a hard sell, but I think I'm trying to think of a good metaphor here. Like, when Dune came out in the 60s, it was commentary on earlier science fiction writing, you know? And I think now, as we're looking at this, like, last decade and a half of superhero movies and the resurgence of Star Wars and the popularity of Marvel, you can trace it back to when the Star Wars prequels came out and movie studios realized they're like, oh, we can mine IP and make sequels on sequels on sequels. What are these big, book titles or IP that we can mine? And then, you had the success of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And then that was when everyone was suddenly like, oh, fantasy novels could have there's a plethora of material right there. And then you get all of the YA novel adaptations with Harry Potter and then every type of Harry Potter spinoff or, other, like all the Maze Runner movies,
Hunger Games, obviously.
They brought back the Narnia movie, like all that stuff.
Yeah.
And now obviously then there's the Marvel whole decade and a half or, two decades now at this point, which is crazy. Yeah. And even the Marvel stuff is kind of reflective of when Nolan introduced his version of Batman and no one had really seen that level of, groundedness, that seriousness, in a superhero movie before. So then of course that kind of creates that paves the way for Iron Man and then the rest of all that stuff. So, Dune coming out now is interesting because, I think it's fair to say, there's a wane in interest in Marvel and Star Wars a little bit. That Dune is a great commentary on all of these popular mythologies that we have today. And Dune is like, well, hey, here's kind of the original thing that Star Wars is based on. Here's the commentary. This isn't just a popular myth. This is showing you, like, here's the problem of putting all of your faith and trust, blind faith and trust into a superhero and what problems that would create. Like most superhero movies end with the superhero winning the day and that's the end of the story. But Dune and its sequels progress past that and show the problems of what that would cause for our future. It's pretty fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, like, Joseph Campbell's whole thing, for better or worse, kind of made it so everybody can kind of recognize the hero's journey in fiction and myth and everything, but also therefore replicate it because it's like, we have to hit these specific beats. And the end of every single one of those is of his version of the hero's journey is, the ruler of two worlds, essentially, where it's like he beats the bad guys and now he is the winner. And then we, like you said, we end because there's nothing after that, because if there's something after that, then that's a new journey. And it, like becomes complicated and people, and because of Star Wars, the first one, we've the joke around the office often is that, Dune ripped off Star Wars, but obviously we know that that's not the way it's the other way around.
I know.
Yeah, I know. You're the one who's always like, guys, you hurt your nose from pushing your glasses up so much. What was I just about to say? But it sort of like took it, polished off the edges of what Dune was doing. It made it so that good and evil were black and white. Which is a good popcorn movie, but anytime they've tried to add, with the exception of Andor, which is doing an amazing job, but anytime they've tried to add subtlety and complexity to some of these Star Wars things, it's felt really forced and also like awkward, because that's just not what the universe is built around.
The thing I appreciate about the Star Wars prequels is that it's just like, we already know Darth Vader is the bad guy.
Right.
So we know going into this, watching this young Anakin, that he is a tragic figure that is doomed to fail. Like that's fun to watch. I enjoy that. Like that's the point of it. He is not the hero. He's doomed to be the villain. But then you get like the original Star Wars trilogy and Luke is the hero. Like he saves the day. But I did enjoy in the sequel trilogy seeing Luke falter. And I think that's a natural thing. Like in The Last Jedi, you see him still conflicted with a lot of stuff. What happens when you're the successful hero and you have to live with it? Do you have these responsibilities? What other problems arise that challenge you being a champion at the end of it? And yeah, I mean, Dune just constantly sets people up and sets them to fail. And it's beautiful. You know, they're all, for me, it's like Greek tragedy or like Hamlet. You know, they literally say like, oh, the Atreides name is derived from Atreus, and the Atreides can trace their lineage all the way back to ancient Terra. And, you know, from the Greeks. And so you see how, yeah, they're all built up in their own mythologies in these books to be these saviors, these heroes, but yet they're always doomed for the dark path.
They're doomed.
They're doomed. So
yeah, I mean, it's been a lot of fun for me getting into that, not least because now I have some frame of reference for what the hell you're talking about half the time, but just getting into the you know, the mindset of this new kind of new to me science fictional world is fun. And just knowing that there's so much material out there that I think
that the access point is a little tricky to try and sell it to someone, because it's just like, you know, once you do look past the sandworms and the weird terminology, you know, at the end of the day, the premise is that, you know, you have your young hero, going to a new world, going to Arrakis, and then he is betrayed and he has to rise back up and fight against, you know, the troubles of the problems of the antagonists. And, you know, he makes new friends, he makes new allies. And then from that, he succeeds. But, you know, that's every myth story. But yeah, the cool part about Dune is you just see like, okay, this path to, you know, or this rise to success isn't just a straight path. There's a lot of other characters that have influence over how that comes about.
And as much as I think a lot of the script writing actually of Christopher Nolan's Dark Knight trilogy is very on the nose and not particularly good or subtle. I in thinking about Dune and Paul's journey and stuff, you think about that line that Harvey Dent says, it's like you either die a hero or live long enough to see yourself become the villain. And it's like,
oh yeah, there's
legitimately what Paul does.
That's why Dune Messiah, the second book of the Dune series, is my favorite. I mean, it really sticks with you, especially, you know, I didn't read the sequels until college. And yeah, after years of reading the first book a couple times through and then finally being like, oh, okay, I think I'm understanding some of the subtleties in this. Dune Messiah really spells stuff out. And there's a famous line that I won't spoil here. But readers of Dune Messiah know, where it's just like Paul kind of compares himself to a very, very evil, very dark historical figure. And Paul just like spells it all out. He's like, yeah, I'm not a good guy. Like I've done some bad things. So Dune Messiah, it definitely gets on the nose for these themes. And it's kind of it's like an abrupt hit when you're reading that when you're young and you're only just still discovering the message of the first book. And yeah, Dune Messiah is great. Anytime someone says that they've read Dune, I just immediately hand them a copy of Dune Messiah.
Got it. Oh, it's much shorter too. So that's another sell.
I mean,
it's
much shorter. I tell people Dune Messiah is basically like just a long epilogue of the first book. And, you know, Frank Herbert wrote the first book and even his publisher was kind of confused and didn't quite get the message of the first one. Even like there's like a letter his publisher sent him and was just like, okay, well, you've got sequels planned, but you've already put Paul at the pedestal. Like he wins. He's the hero. Where do you go on from that? And Frank is just like, that's the point. Like he wrote the first three books, as one in mind. And then until he realized, you know, he had to split them up. So he always had Dune Messiah, Children of Dune all in mind, from the start. But that's why the first book is really like a first act that just is like, okay, great. Now we get the hero story out of the way. The rest of the books are just like, okay, what is that person's legacy? What is the fallout from all of that?
I love a fallout. And we're, a fallout. You know, we're now at a time when we kind of
a Dead Reckoning part one.
Sure.
Can't wait for a whatever is part two.
Yeah. Why did they do that?
I don't know. Maybe they just were like Dead Reckoning Part 2's title doesn't make sense or it doesn't apply to the theme. Just for the record, I called that Dead Reckoning was going to be an artificially intelligent antagonist that could predict the future. After that first trailer, I was very proud of
myself. Did you know that George Romero's original script for the fourth Dead movie was going to be called Dead Reckoning?
Really?
Yeah.
But like spelled like W-R-E-C-K.
Dead Reckoning. And then it eventually became Land of the Dead, but there is still the like big giant like tank in the movie that is called Dead Reckoning.
That's great.
It was going to be like Mad Max. It was going to be like a big like SUV, but with, you know, spikes and chainsaws and stuff like that on it. It was going to like travel through the dead barren wasteland and like, you know, pick up survivors and stuff like that. But obviously that's a lot of, a budget. Yeah. Well, I mean, anybody who hasn't read Dune or hasn't done much research into Dune and you're just looking forward to the second movie, like I would be interested, and I'm sure Matt would be interested too, to like, once you see the second movie, like how much more do you feel like digging in? Like there's all likelihood there's going to be a third movie, and that would, you know,
fingers crossed.
Denis Villeneuve has already said such. So, yeah.
And you know, from interviews that are out by this point, you know, we know that his Dune Part Two is going to be a little different at the end. I mean, we already know that certain characters like Chani and Irulan, a lot of the female characters are given a little bit more agency in the movie adaptation, and rightly so, because you know they can be great perspectives on Paul rather than just seeing stuff only from Paul's perspective. I'm interested to see what differences the movie has from the book, because the book ends kind of abruptly and it confuses a lot of people the first time they read it through, but it, you know, that's kind of the point of how it's supposed to end. So I'm curious to see the differences in it, and if that gets people curious to pick up the book, or people who only read the first half of the book for part one, if they're going to be convinced to finish it after part two. And then fingers crossed if they also just immediately want to start reading Dune Messiah.
I mean, you may as well. It's right there.
It's perfect. It's my favorite. It's real sad. I love it. It's a sad feel good book.
So before we wrap up, how many of the books, because I know Frank Herbert passed away, and I know there's several books that his son and a co-writer wrote afterwards, kind of like utilizing his notes. But how many did Frank Herbert himself actually write?
Frank Herbert wrote six before he passed away. The sixth book, Chapter House Dune, ends on a bit of a cliffhanger. But if you're kind of paying attention to the themes and ideas of these characters by this point, you can kind of see where he's going with it. A lot of Dune is all about embracing the unknown, and that's kind of how that book ends, of just like characters flying off into space into the unknown, and it's kind of a bittersweet fitting ending. And then yes, years after his son Brian Herbert and another writer, Kevin J. Anderson, who was known for writing a lot of Star Wars novels, they claimed they found Frank Herbert's notes for a seventh book. But they decided to write a bunch of prequels. There's the House trilogy that covers the main characters' parents all like right before Dune. You've got the Butlerian Jihad trilogy, which takes place 10,000 years prior and is all about humans revolting against machines and artificial intelligence and automation. You have the Schools trilogy, which is all about how the Bene Gesserit form and the Spacing Guild navigators, etc. And then basically all of these prequels, you kind of have to read to encounter certain characters that do come back around for when Brian Herbert and Kevin J. Anderson wrote book seven, which they turned into two books, Hunters of Dune and Sandworms of Dune, that if you don't read a lot of the prequel stuff, you're going to be like, who are these folks turning up at the very end? So it's a little bit of a roundabout way. There's a couple other books in between some of the originals that they've written, like one is called Paul of Dune, and that takes place between Dune and Dune Messiah. You've got, yeah, they're still cranking them out. So there's a lot to sift through, but I just tell folks, just read the original six first and you'll understand all of the core concepts. You'll understand, especially in the later books, like especially how the Bene Gesserit work, get some of my favorite characters in the later books. Just really cool magical stuff.
This is wild. Like, I'm just looking at the list of ones that Kevin J. Anderson,
and I think there's like 20 to 25 extra books.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Honestly, look, I do what you got to do, but the gall to be like, we found the notes for the seventh book. And now we're going to write 17 other books first before we get to it.
If anything outside of the base six books, I do try to tell people, like, you know, if you can get your hands on it, I mean, I think there's like some PDFs of it floating around online. Try to read the Dune Encyclopedia that was written in the 80s after the fourth book, after God Emperor of Dune came out. So it doesn't take into context anything in Heretics or Chapter House, but the Dune Encyclopedia is an encyclopedia written from the perspective of a historian after the time period of the fourth book. And it recounts, you know, all the way back to ancient Earth, but it explains the past through this lens of, okay, victors in the past have clearly determined how history is recorded, or like religious influences or mythological influences. So it's interesting to read an encyclopedia written from that far into the future, recounting us in the past. And so those, it obviously conflicts with a lot of the Brian Herbert and Anderson books. But that also kind of fits to me in the message of Dune, of how history is recorded versus how it actually happens.
Well, yeah, I mean, that is, you know, one of my favorite things about the book is that you'll get some kind of deep kind of scenes between various characters, especially early on. And then there will be like excerpts from Princess Irulan's like history of it from way later. So and we know history is written by the victors. So it's like, and everything it's is kind of skewed kind of like a certain way.
It's glazing over certain details of like, here's how it actually happened. But we're actually like, I love there's excerpts from what is it? Children's Tales of Muad'Dib, or Children's Book of Muad'Dib. And it's like, how do you explain this religious leader to children? And it's like, yeah, I mean, I read plenty of Bible stories when I was a kid.
Yep.
And how much it's all kind of cleaned up a bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
well, thank you very much for joining me, Matt. I know, you know, we've been wanting to do this one for a while, so thanks for joining me.
Yeah, and
no, we'll have more to talk about, I'm sure, after the the thing comes out. But if people want to get a hold of you or follow you, you tweet a lot about Dune and stuff like that. How can people do that?
I'm on Twitter and Instagram with Hey, It's Matt Caron. My last name is Caron. It's not the girl's name. That's how I had to always explain it in gym. But yeah, I'm usually just tweeting or posting about Dune and making real esoteric inside jokes that, hey, if you read all six books, then you can, you'll get them. So.
And if that's not it,
yeah,
if that's not incentive alone for people to read, understand what Matt's talking about. Yeah. And you can, Matt will have a big video, like you said, about, some fun themes between Dune and Foundation. You're also working on kind of a quick 30 minute up to speed on the first Dune movie before the second one comes out. Whereabouts can people when do you suppose will be out? Maybe it'll be out by the time this goes out, but
I think we're gonna try to roll out this explainer before part two comes out, just so people can kind of get a bit of a recap. Or just, you know, and it's a recap that talks about the movie. I dive into some of the more niche stuff from the book, if you want deeper explanations of why things are working the way they are. But then I think after part two comes out, I'll have a video that is really going to dive into Isaac Asimov's Foundation series and how when Frank Herbert wrote Dune, it was pretty antithetical to a lot of the assumptions made in this like sci-fi staple at the time. And Foundation is still a staple. It's a great book series, but how, when you look at the similarities between Foundation and Dune, you really see how Frank Herbert looks at a villain in Foundation, but twists it around and makes him a hero in Dune. So it's a very, very fun little parallel.
Yeah. And you can follow me on Instagram at functional_nerd. You can follow me on Letterboxd. Matt's also on Letterboxd.
I think right? so. Yeah. All right.
Okay. Well, maybe you're not. I don't know.
Yeah. I gotta reinstall it. I forgot to. every movie I watch, I don't immediately log that I've watched it.
I do.
I need to get back into it.
Letterboxd for me, Kyle_Anderson. Thanks, Matt. Thanks again. And thank you all for listening. Join me again next time on Laser Focus when my guest will be a different person. Bye bye.
Whoa. Bye.
Laser Focus is a production of Nerdist Industries and Legendary Digital Networks. It was produced, edited, and hosted by me, Kyle Anderson. For more, visit Nerdist.com.